This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today we're interviewing George Werthner. He's an outdoorsman, ecologist, author, and photographer, and a writer. He sits on the boards of several environmental and wildlife organizations, and he's studied and written about and photographed natural habitats in many American locales, especially the mountains of the eastern U.S., the lake region of Minnesota, and Cascades and Rocky Mountains of the West. He holds degrees from the University of Montana and the University of California, Santa Cruz, and he's engaged in additional graduate work at Montana State University and the University of Oregon. He's worked in many places in the U.S. from border to border, and he specializes in studying predators. George is the author of 38 books and innumerable articles that have been published in a variety of magazines, including the National Geographic.
So, welcome, George. Good to be talking to you once again, and thanks very much for talking with us today. So let's start talking about the mandate that the U.S. Forest Service has for managing national forests. What is that mandate? What is it supposed to be doing?
Well, the Forest Service has what they call a multiple use mandate, which suggests that all different kinds of activities from resource extraction like logging, mining, oil and gas, drilling, as well as recreation, hunting, fishing, etc., protecting wildlife habitat, all these things are supposed to be allowed on public lands that are managed by the Forest Service. One of the problems, though, with that whole, quote, multiple use concept is that there's nothing in the law that says that any or all those uses must take place on the same acreage of land, and nor does it place any kind of priority, independent of any other decisions about what uses should occur on that. I have run into, a good example is I was objecting to the Forest Service's leasing of grazing in the Upper Green River Valley of Wyoming, which has some of the highest wildlife values. In fact, the Bridger-Teton National Forest suggests, and as far as planned, that the primary management for that zone should be for wildlife. In the objection process, the Forest Service range guy said, well, we're a multiple-use agency, so we have to allow grazing there. Well, no, they don't, yeah. But that's the way it gets interpreted a lot.
Does the Forest Service prioritize any of those different uses?
Well, you could say two things happen. One, first of all, follow the money, and especially when it comes to timber production, logging, there are incentives in the way that the Forest Service is funded that gives more emphasis on logging, and grazing gets an emphasis too, and that's why I say it's two things. Even though it's basically doesn't produce any kind of feedback that's of significance for the agency in terms of money allotted to it, but there's still both of those activities are seen as ways to stimulate rural economies.
Uh-huh.
Even though, again, grazing on public lands insignificant for most areas. Getting back to the Upper Green River, which I mentioned earlier. Less than 1% of the income in Sublette County comes from all grazing, and if you take it as a subset of what's attributed to the public lands portion, it's less than 1%. Nevertheless, there's this whole tendency to emphasize those resource extraction activities over maybe what you might call public benefits. And part of the reason is when people can make money off of something, they'll lobby a lot harder to get their activities approved.
Right.
And just, you and I sitting around saying, well, wouldn't it be nice to see some more elk out there or something?
Yeah. So over the years, has does the priorities change with different administrations?
Well, yeah, there has been some changes. I mean, partly it's economics, too. For example, the timber industry and the livestock industry have both declined in the West for a whole lot of reasons that have nothing to do with public subsidies, etc. It's just, for example, the timber industry has largely migrated to the Southeast because you can grow trees to 10-inch diameter in, you know, 10 to 15 years as opposed to, like in some parts of Montana, you might need 100 years to get a tree to grow that much.
Wow.
So from a purely economic point of view, it doesn't make sense to be logging in Montana, and at least a lot of timber companies have determined that their best interests are served by, you know, closing mills in places like that and going to the Southeast. And also the operational costs are higher in the West. Building roads on mountainsides costs a lot more than it does in the flatlands of Georgia or Mississippi.
Today we're talking particularly about the Custer-Gallatin National Forest as a particular example. And Custer-Gallatin recently renewed its forest plan, and now there's a particular issue dealing with the Cottonwood Canyon region, South Cottonwood Canyon. So the proposal is to engage in logging in South Cottonwood in that drainage. What's going on with that project? Is it going forward? Is it comment period? What's the status?
Well, yes. This is a proposal for what they call the Highlight South Cottonwood area. So part of it would be in Highlight Canyon as well.
Oh, really?
South Cottonwood is right over the ridge line from Highlight Canyon. So this project area would encompass both sides of that divide. One of the differences, though, is South Cottonwood is a roadless area that has been proposed for wilderness by at least conservationists for a long time. And the Highlight area, of course, has been a lot more disturbed by logging and other activities. There's a lot of campgrounds up there because of the Highlight Reservoir, etc. So anyway, what the Forest Service is doing is under some of the recent proclamations from the Trump administration, there's to accelerate what I would call, in quotes, active forest management. And under active forest management, we're talking about logging, prescribed burning, etc., and all of these are being justified in the name of two things. One, to increase, actually, timber production off of public lands, but also to supposedly reduce large wildfires. And so those are the justifications being used in this particular case. And under these executive orders, there are a lot of the normal rules guiding public lands decisions, for example, NEPA, that's the National Environmental Protection Policy Act, which you're supposed to look at what are the environmental impacts of any activity. Those are being either eliminated or reduced in terms of these expedited fire and logging proposals. And that's what's going on in South Cottonwood. Right now, they're taking what they call scoping comments. That is the forest, Custer-Gallatin Forest, taking scoping comments. But there may not be an opportunity after this to have any other impacts on the decision. And so we're seeing this across the board in certain national forests and have been identified for expedited logging and active forest management in the name of trying to reduce the threat of wildfires, particularly of communities that are nearby. In this case, it would be Bozeman, and housing that may be up against the mountains there. Can I go into why this is?
Please do, yeah.
Okay. Well, the problem with a lot of this is that it's based on fallacies regarding how wildfires work. And one of the things that you really have to understand is that all large fires, in other words, ones that burn many thousands of acres, only occur when you have the right climate weather conditions. And they are extended drought, high temperatures, low humidity, in particular, high winds. And when you have high winds, like were, for example, the fires down in Los Angeles last winter in Pacific Palisades and Altadena, you had 100-mile-an-hour winds. And those winds blow embers miles ahead of a fire front.
Uh-huh.
And that makes anything done, like thinning a forest or doing prescribed burning, almost irrelevant because it doesn't work to stop or slow fires under those conditions. But on the other hand, if you don't have those kind of conditions, the vast majority of fires burn like an acre or two and they go out. They self-extinguish,
uh-huh.
Or they're easy to put out. And so one of the problems is the agency can talk about how there used to be so many fires per 100 years or something without acknowledging that most of those fires were small. And we have an example of a study that was done in Yellowstone prior to 1988. The Park Service, and very few studies have been done like this. This is why it's important. But the Park Service decided not to control or suppress any wildfires that were in the backcountry. And they had 235 fires between, I think it was 1972 and 1987, the year before the big fires in Yellowstone in 88. And during that time, 222 of them burned an acre or less of land. And they all self-extinguished.
Mm-hmm.
And even the larger fires all self-extinguished without any kind of suppression efforts.
Mm-hmm.
The point of that being that it makes the point that the vast majority of fires are small and don't amount to a hill of beans. And so you get this bias in the way people look at stuff. They say, well, you know, the Forest Service has suppressed all these fires. In most cases, most of those fires were going to go out anyway, whether you did anything or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then the few that burn under these extreme conditions get much larger. So, you know, look at Yellowstone, at those statistics. Was there so much more fuel in 1988 when a million acres burned in the area versus 1987 when not even a 1,000 acres burned? You know, you can't tell me that suddenly over 1 or 2 years you suddenly got all this more fuel and that's the reason we got the big fires.
Mm-hmm.
And what people have to understand is that it's the climate controls. And there's another factor that is related to all this, which is the active forest management, the thinning, the logging, the prescribed burning, often actually exacerbates fire spread. And the reason is somewhat self-explanatory. If you open up the forest canopy, you're going to have the forest materials on the forest floor as well as the soil dry out faster. You also, as you open up the canopy, you make it easier for the wind to penetrate. So these are the very things that lead to larger fires. And the interesting thing is, again, another factor is that green trees under drought conditions, and that's my qualifier,
uh-huh.
are actually more flammable than dead trees. And the reason is because, you know, something, whether it's lodgepole pine, Douglas fir, whatever the common tree species are there, under drought conditions, their internal moisture can drop very low, lower than kiln-dry lumber. And yet they still have needles and all this fine fuel on the branches that are full of resins that are flammable. And in fact, it's not surprising if you were to geographically map all the fires that have occurred in the West, the vast majority of them happen in green forests because they're actually more vulnerable to fire than the dead tree snags after, say, a mountain pine beetle or even a previous wildfire. So the proposal that they have for the Highlight South Cottonwood, justifying it in the name of reducing large wildfires and the threat to Bozeman, it doesn't really hold up to scrutiny. And you may ask, why do they do this? Well, I give you a couple of theories. One of the things is a lot of the research on active forest management and its influence on fires is done by the Forest Service itself or scientists who work in forestry schools and get their funding from the Forest Service. So that sort of influences the kind of questions they ask. And I'm not suggesting these scientists are lying or anything like that, but how you pose your question can make a difference. The second reason is if you're the district ranger, say the Bozeman district ranger, and you have a choice between doing, quote, active forest management in the presumption that you will reduce wildfires, and a big wildfire occurs, nobody's going to blame you if their house burns down that you didn't do something that could have prevented this. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you don't do anything and somebody's house burns down, you're going to get the blame and suffer consequences. So there's a big incentive for the Forest Service to do something under the presumption that something is better than nothing.
So in the South Cottonwood area and around a highlight reservoir, what kind of tree grows? A lodgepole pine? Is there anything else?
Yeah, it's a lot of it's lodgepole pine. There's some Douglas fir, there's some aspen, and up higher subalpine fir. But all those species tend to have longer fire rotations. You know, there's this whole another I would call myth, without getting into too much of the nuances, that fires were very frequent and low severity and kept fuels down across the West. And in fact, that idea does apply to some very dry forests in places like Arizona, Ponderosa Pine Forest there, and a few other parts of the West, but it doesn't apply to the vast majority of tree species in the West, and lodgepole pine is a good example. It often has what are called a fire rotation, the interval between fires of hundreds of years. And so even if fire suppression were effective, and that's another assumption that can be challenged,
mm-hmm.
whether it's actually been effective, even if it was effective, if you've got a 200-year fire rotation, well, then you haven't changed anything because we have hardly had 200, we haven't had 200 years go by where fire suppression could have changed
right.
that overall fire rotation. And the other part of this, in how climate affects things, and it's an important thing, if you go back into the last century, the 1900s, you will find that at the early part of the century, it was extremely dry. Think about, the 1920s and 30s, the Dust Bowl days.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, significant acreage around the West was burning. In fact, in 29 or 28, somewhere like that, 50 million acres are estimated to have burned. And why is that important? Because even today, under quote, because of fire suppression and all these excuses that are given, and people mm-hmm. are suggesting we're having more acreage burn, a 10 million acres in a summer is considered a lot. So back in the early 1900s, we had very large acreages burned. And then back around the mid-1930s and into the 1940s, the climate grew cooler and moister around the West. Glaciers were growing on the mountains in the Cascades, for example, at that time. They're shrinking like crazy right now.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, it was cooler and moister, and snow was accumulating, and mm-hmm. glaciers were getting bigger. And so what do you have when you have cooler, moister conditions? Well, first of all, you get fewer ignitions to begin with, and even the ones you get don't spread. The fires don't spread very much. So all through, like, the 1940s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the amount of acreage burning was significantly lower. And this is when the Forest Service suggests fire suppression was so effective. Well, nature was effective at fire suppression. And mm-hmm. and we took, you know, we used the way the climate affected the fires to suggest that we made a big difference. And then towards the end of the 1970s and into the 1980s, the climate started getting warmer and drier, largely because of climate change and human emissions of carbon into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, that reversed what was, you know, when I started school over at the University of Montana, my professors were talking about how we were going to enter another ice age, and we had these discussions in class of how we're going to feed the country when the glaciers come south and take over the, you know, the cornfields of Iowa or something like that. So the point being is that that climate change was reversed by carbon emissions from humans finally started to reverse what it would have probably continued on that route as cooler, moister climate. So what we have today is climate warming changing how forests burn, because it doesn't take much in the way of a temperature increase to greatly increase the vapor barrier deficit, which has to do with how vulnerable plants are to burning,
mm-hmm.
Significantly. So, yes, we are having a problem with wildfires being larger, but it's due to climate change. And the fact is that these active forest management protocols aren't doing anything about the climate. And in fact, in many cases, they're actually making the conditions in the forest stands more likely to burn rather than less likely to burn.
Is the Fix Our Forest Act is that contributing to the policy that the Forest Service wants to implement?
That's exactly what's happening in Fix Our Forest, and you know I really think we should be re-emphasizing it and taking money and call it Fix Our Climate. But the Fix Our Forest it assumes that there's a problem with the forest that can be rectified by primary logging. And you know, here's another interesting statistic. If you look at the mortality from, you know, the Forest Service has what I call chainsaw medicine. They think the forests are unhealthy, and it's defined as, oh well, if there's mountain pine beetles that kill trees, that's a sign of being an unhealthy forest. Or if a drought kills trees, that's an unhealthy forest. Or wildfire kills trees, that's an unhealthy forest. But chainsaws are not unhealthy, according to the Forest Service. It's the medicine that fixes these things.
Yeah.
And the irony of all that is that the chainsaws actually make the forest less healthy from an ecological point of view. And I know this is something a lot of people would find maybe difficult to agree with, but you know, there's a lot of plants and animals that depend on dead trees and the snag forests that result from things like pine beetles or wildfire create habitat that's important for many, many, many species of animals and plants. And I'll just give you a couple of rundowns. There's a lot of documented science that shows you have more wildflowers in recently burned forests or places where there've been pine beetle mortality. There's more bees. There's more bird species in a lot of cases in these snag forests. There's of course more fish in streams because the logs, the dead wood that gets into the streams, provides habitat for aquatic insects. So you actually get more fish and bigger fish in areas that have burned. You get more bats in the snag forests. You get more, growth of aspen and other food for things like elk. And so, anyway, I can go on and on. But the idea that a burnt forest is a biological desert is inaccurate. It is actually one of the most biologically diverse habitats out there. And the problem with it is it doesn't last very long because within, you know, it depends on where we're talking about, but within 30 to 50, 60 years, you start getting all this regrowth and the snags fall down. And so you start losing a lot of that biological legacy. And it's important to recognize that these kinds of things like a major wildfire or whatever are episodic. They don't happen that often. So you may go 100 years between a major fire that creates this habitat, and then the habitat gradually declines, you know, almost back to zero, waiting on the next major event that'll happen and recreate that snag forest habitat.
The Forest Service proposal is to treat the forest, and that, I suppose, is a euphemism for what, prescribed burning or?
For logging and prescribed burning.
Uh-huh.
And I want to, I might as well address the prescribed burning thing, too, right now. All these things, there's a certain time factor involved in them. If you were to burn an area and basically eliminate most of the surface fuels, and you got a fire at that place that very summer, yeah, it might slow a fire down. But what's the probability of a fire encountering a place that's treated? Well, it's very, very low, less than 1%. And when you do things like prescribed burning and logging, you have ecological impacts that result that are negative. You have more soil erosion. If you've got to build roads like in this highlight, South Cottonwood, they're planning on building 10 miles, quote, of temporary roads. And a temporary road is just as bad on the environment as a non-temporary road, at least why it's being used. You get more soil erosion, you get more access for hunters, you have, so you displace wildlife, you get spread of weeds on those roads, et cetera. So the idea that, okay, we have a 1%, less than 1% chance that a fire will actually occur in these areas in the time when anything done like reduction of fuels is effective, and yet you're guaranteed to get all the impacts. So that raises the whole question, is this really worthwhile? And then, as I mentioned earlier, when you have the high-severity fire weather conditions, winds are going to blow embers over any treated area that you have. I can give you numerous examples. There was a fire in Oregon called the Eagle Fire a number of years ago in the Columbia Gorge. The embers from that fire were blown by winds across the mile-and-a-half-wide Columbia River to start fires on the Washington side of the river.
Yeah.
And there's no fuel out there. I mean, if a mile-and-a-half-wide river isn't going to block wind-blown embers, why would anybody think that a thin forest or even a prescribed burn would have any kind of effect? So we really have to realize that the conditions under which a fire's burn greatly affects the effectiveness of it. And this gets back to the research that I was talking about, the Forest Service research. Like one, I read stuff all the time. I have a Google search every day for words like California wildfires, wildfire ecology, et cetera. And so I'm kind of pretty much aware of any research that comes up. And I at least look at what the abstracts are. And one of the things you'll see a lot of times is, this will be an example. There might be research that shows that thinning the forest reduce fire spread. But and then you read the details of that study, and they combined all the kinds of fires that occurred under all weather conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And under low to moderate weather conditions, fires don't spread very much anyway. Like I said, they mostly self-extinguish.
Yeah.
And so if you throw in the large fires are less than 1% of all fires. If you throw that in with the 99% of fires that are small, burning under low and moderate conditions, well, then you can definitely say that, well, it seems like thinning has an effect on fire spread. But you're ignoring the few fires that are so big and burning under the high severity conditions that totally negate all that, blending together of those fires.
George, we are just about out of time, but the comment period on this for the Forest Service is it still May 30th, or
yes,
did they postpone it?
As far as I know, it's still May 30th, but I would encourage people to still write the Forest Service even after that date, because they may respond to enough public opposition, particularly for the South Cottonwood drainage.
And they respond to the Forest Service in Bozeman?
Yes.
Okay. I have the address for that, and I'll insert it. Okay, George, well, it's great to be talking with you, but we've run out of time, so thank you very much. Maybe we can do another one shortly. Thanks, George. This has been Wilderness.
Thank you.
This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. More information about the association and its activities can be found at its website, www.gallatinwildlife.org. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.